Votes most, many of them, but in a different order. Some of the things aren't even in the notes. I'm going to have stuff about superfluidity and superconductivity, which more or less you all asked me for, I'll put in. My apologies to deviate from what's up on the web and all that kind of stuff. I start talking about history. I have great affection for the year 1937. It's an important year in critical phenomena and phase transitions. It's also an important year in my life since I was born that year. I won't then be talking about, later on I'll talk about stuff I know firsthand, but most of this lecture will be devoted to 1937, and I can only give you second and third hand information about it. You used to own a stick, huh? Oh, well. Landau pointed out a basic unity among the different mean field theories. He pointed out that phase transitions were a manifestation of a broken symmetry and used the order parameter to measure the extent of the broken symmetry. For example, in the Ising model, the spin can either point that way or that way. They tend to line up, and that's a broken symmetry. The ferromagnet, the amount of lining up, is measured by the order parameter, which is a magnetization. That says how much order there is in the system. In the fluid, the order parameter is the density minus the critical density, and the value of that says how thoroughly you were into the liquid or gas state. Mathematically, Landau was good at math. And he had some knowledge of classical chemical physics and a considerable knowledge of mathematics. By this time, he was stuck in the Soviet Union, and communications weren't too great with the outside world, so he had to do his own thing and did a great job for doing his own thing. He generalized the many different mean field theories by assuming that you could expand the free energy in an order parameter. Here I'll take the order parameter to be a magnetization and give it a symbol M, but the expansion is the same for all different kinds of phase transitions, except perhaps that the order parameter has different symmetry properties. Here I'll imagine that what we have is a magnetization that can point in two different directions. You could also have a magnetization which is a vector quantity which can point in any direction in a plane, or you could have a magnetization which is a vector quantity point any direction in three-dimensional space. This could also be a complex quantity, lots of other things. This expansion assumes a small order parameter, and that is, you can't expand an M unless it's somehow small, and small fluctuations, because you're thinking about the average magnetization. That works far away from the critical point. The small order parameter works near the critical point. Here we have, in this expansion, H is the magnetic field. Small c, this term, is proportional temperature minus critical temperature. If you've looked at this with a critical eye, I seem to be suggesting that this would never work. In fact, it does work equally well every place. Yes?
Is that the fluctuation?
Yes. This is a kind of fluctuation term, and the fluctuations have been taken into account to the extent that the average order parameter has a gradient in it. However, in fact, if one did an expansion of this, one can't do an expansion of this type. Either in two dimensions or three dimensions, the free energy is a singular function of the order parameter, and this expansion simply doesn't work near the critical point. and it's not, it doesn't work far away. However, it gives you, as being field gives you, good qualitative description of the behavior sort of every place. Landau didn't know that it was not going to work. Landau, at this point, believed that it was going to work beautifully. What you do next is you say that the magnetization is a parameter in the system. You vary that, you imagine varying that magnetization so as to minimize the free energy. That gives you an equation for the magnetization. I'll write it down a tiny bit. And then when you solve that equation, you get the magnetization of the function of field and T minus TC. You get some kind of singularities in the neighborhood of the critical point, and the thing looks pretty good. Here's the arithmetic to do the variational stuff. You imagine changing M in this form for the free energy. You then get the change in M times minus H from here. You get 2T because M squared times M there. That's the usual differentiation stuff. You get 4C times N cubed from this term. And you have to, in order to pull out the change in M, do an integration by parts in this term. And that gives you a minus sign. To minimize F, the coefficient, that is the thing in the square brackets, must vanish. And then you get M obeying this equation. We have now an equation for M. This is a cubic equation. It is, in fact, exactly of the same form as we got from talking about what happens near the critical point in the our expansion of the Isaac model. It, except for changes of variables, is exactly the same thing as the van der Waals equation. Here, because M can take it can be either positive or negative, what we have is a reflection of what is called a Z2 symmetry. That is a symmetry in which you can point in two different directions. It says it's the, our result is the same cubic theory as before. The theory includes the free energy. There it is. And so when there are several solutions, as there are below TC, we can always pick the right one. Why minimize? Thermodynamics says that the free energy is extremized by the variation in any macroscopic parameter. In fact, is minimized by the choice of any macroscopic parameter. That is, any extensive variable, any variable that extends over the entire system. This is part of a general idea that the free energy is a probability, which arises from how that idea arises from how the partition function is used. In statistical mechanics, you only see the things that have a high probability. Improbable things may be going on with a low probability, but you don't see them. This applies to all macroscopic phenomena. Now, the magnetization is a function of R is not exactly a macroscopic parameter, but Landau's idea that long wavelengths was macroscopic enough so that one could neglect its fluctuations. This point of view has turned out to be wildly successful. Question?
In the previous slide, you showed the same basic Z2 symmetry on the negative change of M. I don't know whether it's the negative change of the magnetization or the negative change of the parameter.
Okay. Let's go back one slide. You notice that this term is special among these terms, and that this term is odd in M. That's because a magnetic field breaks the symmetry between up and down. And so this term, if you change both the sign of H and the sign of M, would give you the same thing as before. Here is an even term in M, another even term in M, a third even term in M. The evenness of this in M is, in fact, the Z2 symmetry. If the symmetry is flipping the side of M and H, and all of these terms are unchanged if you do that. If you put in a cubic term, that term breaks the symmetry, And according to Landau's calculation, it kills the continuous phase transition and gives you a first-order phase transition as the result. I don't know if I answered your question, but I talked about it.
I have a cold, which is particularly bothering me today, and that particularly settles in my ears, so I do my best. Okay.
This approach, using the free energy and minimizing, is in extensive use to this very day. Here is a paper by authors whom you know, Dennis and John, and I don't know Callan, but they do. This is a paper from 2008 in which they were talking about the effect of impurities upon superconductors, and they took a free energy, which is the free energy of the normal system, plus something of exactly the form that Landau used, except they were worrying about a superconductor. A superconductor has an order parameter which is complex, and psi of r is a complex function, and you're supposed to minimize the free energy with respect to that complex function. The order parameter and the free energy were the crucial concepts used by Landau. Free energy could be expressed in terms of any descriptors of system behavior. If you're doing a variational principle, you don't have to know from the beginning what variables you should use. You use any variables which seem reasonable to you, and something like the free energy is minimized by the correct choice, that is, the correct value of any one of the variables. So we've come loose from the particular thermodynamic variables handed to us by our forefathers, pressure, volume, blah, blah, blah. We can use, for example, as an order parameter, something that represents an antiferromagnet, the number of spin ups on one lattice, the number of spin downs on a neighboring lattice could be an order parameter, and we could be looking at the ordering that goes up and down and up and down. In fact, this business of using the free energy and using variational arguments got to be very fashionable very quickly. Julian Schwinger, whom I'm going to mention later on in terms of the invention of the renormalization thing for electrodynamics, was working on electromagnetic fields for World War II radar. He used variational methods and effective fields, lumped variables they were called, to build electromagnetic circuits. Between them, Landau and Schwinger and other people also made the use of these variational principles very popular in physics. Okay, that takes care of how Landau, I'll have some more words about this, but basically Landau put together an exposition of what happens in a phase transition. That exposition in Landau's 1937 work covered all different kinds of phase transitions and was very interesting and persuasive. It looked just right. People loved the idea that you could do all different phase transitions with a single theory, and that point of view caught on. However, that's not the only thing that I'm going to talk about in 1937. In the same 1937, there was a statistical mechanics conference in Amsterdam celebrating the 100th anniversary of van der Waals' birth. Excellent people who, chemists and physicists doing statistical mechanics were present there. The three names that I want to point you to are Peter Debye, Uhlenbeck, and Cramers. Cramers knew something that the other guys didn't know about so much. He had looked at the structure of the theory, and he noticed that the original form of the Van der Waals theory, which didn't have Maxwell's jumps in it, was interesting, but didn't agree with experiment. Maxwell's jumps gave singularities, sharp points here as you jumped from liquid to vapor, or singularities here at the critical temperature. He pointed out that such singularities, and there was a session at the meeting, and he pointed out at that session, he was in the chair, he pointed out that such singularities were inconsistent with the statistical mechanics of any finite system. So this picture is incompatible with thermodynamics because it's unstable, and this picture is incompatible with statistical mechanics. And his pointing that confused the people at the conference no end. The conference was perplexed. What do you do if you're all confused? You vote. So they voted. Well, maybe you know. I don't know what you do. It voted on the proposition of whether statistical mechanics could describe the liquid region. They knew very well that there were experiments compared with theory that in this vapor region, statistical mechanics was giving an excellent description of what was going on. They had all kinds of corrections to PV as NKT and knew that statistical mechanics gave good representation. And only very barely the beginnings of a theory of the statistical mechanics of liquids. So they said, well, we have a jump between here and there. That jump is inconsistent with the statistical mechanics of any finite system. Maybe what happens is that you can't use statistical mechanics to describe the properties of liquids. So they had a vote on the proposition of whether statistical mechanics could describe the liquid region. The outcome of the vote was 50-50, with Debye showing up on the wrong side. He voted no. That's the wrong side because we know right now that after many calculations, the statistical mechanics can describe the properties of liquids. I'm going to be talking in the next 4 days a lot about renormalization. This same Kramers guy introduced the idea of renormalization, and he introduced it in a classical context, so he's an important person from our point of view. I'm going to be saying sort of personal things about people in the next three lectures. Kramers always had the bad luck of coming to every subject a little bit late. He worked with the other inventors of quantum mechanics, never got a tremendous amount of credit for anything, since everybody else always invented things just a little bit before he did. This business about pointing out this inconsistency that had to do with singularities was also forgotten. Nobody connected it with the name of Kramers until I did some historical research. I'm going the wrong direction. Let's go forward. Okay. Arthur Whiteman, a mathematical physicist from Princeton, said that there's one aspect of the thermodynamic limit, that is the limit as n goes to infinity, that Gibbs did not emphasize. He was talking at a conference which celebrated some anniversary of Gibbs's birth or something like that, and the conference was all about Gibbs, and Whiteman said that the appearance of phase transitions between distinct thermodynamic phases is something that Gibbs didn't emphasize. In fact, he didn't talk about it at all. I looked through his collected works. There's nothing like that in there. Whiteman said the sharp phase transitions do not occur in finite systems. That's more or less the extended singularity theorem. A little more pedagogical zeal by Gibbs. Well, Gibbs is the sort of guy who was pretty good at math, and he certainly could have figured that out. I'm not sure that he did. A little more pedagogical zeal by Gibbs, according to Whiteman, could have saved some of the generations that followed considerable time. Gibbs could have told them it was pointless to discuss phase transitions, except in the thermodynamic limit. This bears directly on the use of mean field theory. Mean field theory never really asks that the system be infinite in extent. It works, for example, in a system with periodic boundary conditions. So this point of view that you need an infinite system for phase transitions would show, and I'm going to say this several times, would show that mean field theory wasn't exactly quite right. On the other hand, mean field theory was extremely productive. It enabled us to understand a whole bunch of different phase transitions and enabled people to do interesting and worthwhile things for a large variety of systems. So if Gibbs had written that you needed an infinite system for phase transitions, it would have just set back scientific progress. We're sort of lucky that it wasn't recognized until 1937 that you needed that mean field theory had major problems. Okay, I'm going to talk to you about what this picture means from today's perspective. Thermodynamic phase transitions involve singularities, and singularities and infinities that arise almost always from unbounded number of particles. What happens really is that there's a slight rounding at this quarter and a slight rounding at this quarter in any real system. As the system becomes larger and larger, this rounding becomes sharper and sharper, and in fact, it is almost invisible in most of the real cases. The real systems contain huge numbers of particles. A liter, a mole of material contains 10 to the 23rd particles. That's a huge number, and that means that the rounding here is over a very, very, very small region. Mean field theory also fails up there. There is there are singularities in the free energy that are different from the ones Landau gave us. That is, the mean field theory fails at the neighborhood of the critical point. There we can see much better the failure if we want to look for it. The other thing that happened in the years after Van der Waals is that we didn't want to look. We followed Kamerly Otis's advice, so to speak, and didn't pay any attention to the region near the critical point. Landau, however, brought our attention back to that region because his theory was supposed to apply to that region. So the unexpected indirect implication of what Landau's work was is to bring our attention back towards the critical point. In practice, the coherence length describes the spatial extent of the fluctuations that produce the singularities. The coherence length goes to infinity, or at least gets very large, and the larger the system, the better chance the coherence length gets to be large. That's our basic understanding of how come we have singularities in an infinite system. We see them in part in big systems, and we see them in part because the coherence length goes to infinity. Conclusion we have to draw is that the approximate theories of statistical mechanics, that is, mean field theory, must be improved in the neighborhood of the critical point. This says the same thing as I've already said. The fact that nobody paid much attention to Kramers gives me an opportunity, or gave me an opportunity, to name the result that Kramers explained in 1937. I call it the extended singularity theorem. It's extended because the anomalous thermodynamic behavior is caused by the whole infinite system. Singularity because the anomalous behavior is a singularity. Theorem because I want to emphasize that this is a mathematically rigorous result. It says here that this should have pointed to a major difficulty of mean field theory. People ignored it. Okay. I'm going to do a little more history now. Up until this point, I've said entirely nice things about people, and I've been I've had things I wanted to say more or less in public. At this point, I'm going to.
strange order.
Yang and Li, who are two pretty good mathematicians, better than pretty good, actually. Yang and Li, who are two very good mathematicians, wrote a paper in the 1960s, I would guess, maybe the 1970s, explaining why off-diagonal long-range order, why taking this expectation value was the reasonable thing to do. Let me continue. You would write as an operator equation. I didn't put h-bars into my slide. H-bar doesn't come very naturally with Keynote, and I was too lazy to look it up. This is the potential between two helium atoms, V of R minus S, and I make this an R and C, and then I have a V of R minus S times psi squared at S and T, and then psi at R and T, and I ought to be careful putting the normal ordering that would be put into such stuff. You then, according to this line of work, which started out with Bogoliubov and then continued with Belyavin. Again, you remember, Dennis, but I don't remember. Belyavin and, oh well. In any case, what you do is you write psi of RT is the average value of psi of RT plus the deviation from the average value. And you will start expanding in that deviation. That's how you develop a theory of a superfluid helium. And that's sort of what the way the modern theory works. This has been carried lots further. Bogoliubov is the guy who did it first. Now, I mentioned that, from the wrong direction. I mentioned that because, in fact, his work has been, to some extent, overlooked. The Landau School, which is the other major group of people working on this, has sort of pushed references to Bogoliubov into the background. I am, although I'm not... I was sort of on the spot, not colloquially, but I was at the right place. It was sort of not exactly the right time. BCS theory, which is the basic microscopic theory of superconductivity, was done in 1956 and 1957 at the University of Illinois Urbana. In 1962, I came to work in the group intellectually headed by John Bardeen at the University of Illinois, and I saw a lot about John and how he did things. But the reason that this damn thing's turned off is that I want to tell you last night, and you will discuss other things, Bob. Robert, J. Robert Friedman. I took his job at Urbana. He went off to be a bigger shot at the University of Pennsylvania, and I went to Urbana to be an assistant professor. He was getting that. Okay. So, these people, with their working together, produced a tremendously impressive theory of superconductivity. However, there's more to be said about it. And I remind you that the hydrodynamics is an important subject. Different phases of matter are qualitatively different. This isn't true of the liquid vapor system, because liquids and vapors are qualitatively similar. But otherwise, each phase has a different symmetry and different ordering properties. For example, a liquid has no rigidity, so it can't transfer a torque over a long distance, but a solid can. At low frequency, momentum transfer in liquids involves one kind of sound waves and two components of diffusion by viscosity. This viscous thing is described what is called the Navier-Stokes equation, which is written down here, which is an equation that gives the time derivative of the viscosity of the velocity in terms of the viscosity and del squared of the velocity. In contrast, solids have an entirely different hydrodynamics, an entirely different long wavelength behavior, in which they have three modes of sound propagation, each of which obeys an equation of the form of the wave equation, and three which can be different velocities of sound. Superfluids, now I'm coming back again to the superconducting case. Superfluids have a special superflow processes which cannot occur in an ordinary liquid. In the simplest time-independent limit, the slow changes are described by a nonlinear Schrodinger equation of the I copied this out of Wikipedia, and now I'm trying to figure out what did I copy. Okay. The simplest time-independent limit, the slow processes of a superconductor, are described by a nonlinear Schrodinger equation, essentially the same form as the Gross-Kreisky equation, which I told you about. In fact, Dennis told you about. Not the same form. It is the Gross-Kreisky equation. It's like part of my confusion. My cold has gotten to my head. So superfluids obey the Gross-Kreisky equation. There's the form of the Gross-Kreisky equation. But I want to go on beyond the Gross-Kreisky equation, and beyond the flow properties of superfluids, which I already told you a little bit about, to superconductors. An analogous special equation describes the behavior of the hydrodynamic processes in superconductors. This equation is exactly of the form of the equations that Landau wrote down in 1937. It is for a complex wave function, which is the wave function of the bound state of the two electrons. And it has in it the electromagnetic potential, the electromagnetic field in the form of a potential, A of R and T. The behavior of A was known because of the work of Meissner and then the later more phenomenological theory of London. This equation is called the Landau-Ginzburg equation, and it was done by Landau and Ginzburg, two Landau school physicists, in 1953, I believe. But in any case, a few years before BCS. And then something peculiar happened. Yes, please.
What are the alpha and beta in the equation?
I didn't understand the question.
So what are the alpha and beta in the
equation? Okay.
These
are the same thing as the coefficients that we use in the Landau-Ginzburg theory. And this one is proportional to T minus TC as you get closer to the critical point. Beta is a descriptor. I'm not telling you anything, but beta describes the strength of the nonlinear interactions. You can, in fact, in this form, fix up the value of beta by changing the scale of psi. It doesn't change anything, so beta actually doesn't have much content in the formula equation. And finally, the electromagnetic current is given by the variation of the free energy as you vary the vector potential A. A significant factor here, which you did not ask, is what is the 2? I thought you knew what 2 was, but in fact this 2 is important because this is twice the charge on an electron, and in fact it describes, this equation describes the behavior of electron pairs. Landau and Ginzburg originally got this wrong, they put it in E, but after a while it got fixed up. Now, there were several reasons why this did not, percolate through to Urbana. One reason was the strange one. This was a height of the Cold War. There was no good communication between Urbana and Moscow. And the weak link that existed was the journals passed from one place to the other. However, journals from Russia got involved in the patriotism of the New York longshoremen, who decided that they didn't like Russia and took all the journals from Russia one year and dumped them into the Hudson River. Tea Party kind of behavior hurt the communications, so that Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer did not know about this work. They should have known, they should have understood that this might be just a simple consequence of the 1937 Landau work. It's got the same form as the 1937 Landau work, except for this thing being a complex wave function. Bardeen was focused on the microscopic properties, the behavior of the quasi-particles. This was more macroscopic. This involved more flow properties, and Bardeen did not focus his attention on that. So the BCS theory was done without any understanding of the Ginzburg-Landau theory, which gave these equations. This started to really hurt a couple of years later. A young physicist in Britain by the name of Brian Josephson, yes indeed young, the first work I'm going to talk about, he was 20 odd. The second Josephson effect, he was 23. Let me start out with the early part of the story, and then I'll come to the part that has to do with superconductivity. Once upon a time, there were two groups measuring the effect, the general relativistic effect on photons. What they would do is to take photons produced by a nuclear transition in what is called the Bossbauer effect, produce a transition in one material and catch the photons in another material 20 meters below. What they were trying to do was to see the shift in the frequency of the photons
produced by the general relativistic effect. This work was considered to be extremely exciting, and the groups were working night and day to get their Nobel Prizes. Josephson wrote a note to the British group, which was working at the Atomic Energy Agency in Harwell. And he said, well, you know, the Doppler effect caused by the thermal motion of the atoms is going to shift the frequency more than the 20 feet that you're measuring. The important physicists at Harwell received the note and called up Josephson at his college at Cambridge. When the porter answered the telephone at the college at Cambridge, he replied that they did not deign to call undergraduates to the telephone. And so he would not relay the message from Harwell to Josephson. The next thing that happened was the guys from Harwell came by car to talk to Josephson. And in fact, Josephson explained to them why their experiment wasn't working and what they should do to make the experiment work properly. Fast forward like 3 years, BCS theory had been working, and people had started to study what was going on by what is called tunneling process. Here's a skinny insulator, a semiconductor. Here are some fat metals. In fact, let me mark them as normal metal and superconducting metal. And you apply a voltage across. Let me see what I can do here. Voltage. How do you do that? Yes, you do it that way. You apply a voltage across this, and electrons go from one side to the other. They tunnel across the barrier. If you measure the dependence of current on voltage, you are measuring something that has a lot to do with the densities of states and properties of the superconductor and of the normal metal. This was known. There was a theory of it, lots of theory of it. Josephson pointed out in 1963 or 64, that this was okay for the normal metal superconductor, but if you had two superconductors, something different would happen. There would be a superconducting wave function. That wave function would have a barrier penetration effect, and it would appear on the other side. If you, in fact, put two, you put two superconductors in contact, if you have a phase of the wave function alpha on this side and alpha prime on that side, you get a current proportional to psi of alpha minus alpha prime produced by the phase of the wave function and the wave function tunneling across from one side to the other. Bardeen hadn't understood, actually, the Landau-Ginzburg work. By this time, the longshoremen had turned their attention to other things. They were beating up protesters against the Vietnam War and weren't so interested in physics journals. The longshoremen had turned their attention to other things, and the Landau-Ginzburg work had come across the ocean. However, Josephson's pointed out this superconducting to superconducting tunneling was an entirely new and foreign idea to Bardeen. Bardeen was open to new ideas, but he thought he understood superconductivity, and never really, I think, understood the wave function point of view. In any case, Bardeen said at a meeting of the low temperature physics people that Josephson was wrong. This wouldn't happen. Well, Josephson was right. It would happen. It did happen. It was measured to happen. And Bardeen struggled to understand it and worked very hard to figure out what was going on. Bardeen's incorrect picture involved not the tunneling needing to have the quasi-particles of the superconductor come apart before they can tunnel across there. They would have to tunnel two quasi-particles to do this, and that would require four factors of the wave function decay, the so-called tunneling amplitude. Here, if you push the pair through, the wave function, it could do it with two factors. And that made a tremendous difference in how much current went through. In any case, Josephson was right, Bardeen was wrong, and at the next meeting of the Low Temperature Association, Bardeen, in a, what I think was a great gesture, got up and said, Josephson was right, and I, Bardeen, was wrong. And that was a very, very fine thing to do. Now, let me tell you a little more about Josephson. Josephson is an interesting person. I have two of his more recent publications here. Again, I just copied stuff out of Wikipedia. This recent publication is on, has a title, Telepathy Works. It is what you might expect it to be under that title. And Defining Consciousness is roughly what you might expect that to be also. I know Brian pretty well because he came to Urbana as a research assistant professor in his period after the Josephson effect. So we sort of worked together. Brian, well, you got a picture of him on the right there, roughly in that period, was a shy and sensitive and socially, no, shy and sensitive individual. One of the secretaries described him coming into her office and his standing all the way on the other side of the office to keep away from her. Whatever. He started to turn his attention in the period after Urbana to things that involve human perceptions and maybe somewhat less physical things, and went off to see the Maharishi after a while, who was apparently teaching him to levitate. That was a little strange. Let me tell you the levitation story. Then I'll come back to the Maharishi's visit to the Maharishi. After that, a bunch of people, physicists, were sitting around at a table with the King of Belgium after some scientific meeting. The King of Belgium was also of the telepathy work sort, and was asking Brian about how his levitation was doing. Brian told them, and the physicists behaved as you might have expected the physicists behaving. They were somewhat dubious about the levitation. Brian, according to the story, and this is only secondhand, the third hand I'm telling this particular one. Brian, according to the story, then left the table to go to the John or something, And the King of Belgium said, you know, you physicists are unnecessarily hard on that nice young man. In any case, back to the Maharishis. Now, this tremendously shy young man went off to the Maharishis and was learning to levitate. I will not comment on the levitation possibilities. I will, however, point out that at the very same time, a beautiful and down-to-earth woman was also visiting at the Maharishis. Now, down-to-earth perhaps may not be consistent with levitation, but nonetheless, the woman was beautiful. She was a model, and I know her. She's down-to-earth. And the two of them hooked up, got married, and so Shai Bryant ended up with the most wonderful wife of all the physicists I know. I don't know quite what to make of the story, but there it is for you. I have one more of a similar kind, which I think I can copy from Wikipedia. I didn't know these people first time. Heisenberg and Dirac, people whose names you know, were sailing on a cruise ship. They made an odd couple. Heisenberg spent his time chasing after the ladies, and Dirac certainly did not. Dirac, like Bardeen, was someone who didn't talk much. He asked Bardeen a question, and you stand there, and you stand there, and you stand there, and you wait for the reply. My wife at the time describes asking John, did you have a nice time on your summer vacation? She stood there and stood there, and finally the answer came back, yes. Now, Dirac was sort of the same way. In physics, we have great possibilities for taking all sorts of people in and having them do their wonderful things with us and for us. Dirac also made an excellent marriage. Dirac married the sister of Eugene Wigner, a major important mathematical physicist from Princeton. And as far as one could tell, they lived happily ever after. Too was an excellent marriage. Exactly how ladies can stay married to people who don't talk is not quite clear. But Jane Bardeen, John's wife, said that if you stood there long enough, you could get a good reply and it would enlighten you, and you just had to have patience. Dirac also didn't talk, but I'm told that Wigner's sister talked enough for two. Okay. This says I can turn the sound back on. I told you enough stories out of school. And you found out what the English expression out of school means.
It means that you can turn this, that you have to turn the sound off. Okay. I'm going to start next time talking about fluctuations. I think I'm done with talking about figures in physics. I'm happy to answer questions or listen to comments.
Or tell you about superconductivity, for that matter. Okay, it's lunchtime.
Yeah, thank you.